Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 62, titled Birth and Life of Shakyamuni Buddha.
Does everyone know the expression Bodhisattva? Bodhisattva means a hero of enlightenment. Bodhi means enlightenment, and Sattva means a hero. Usually it can also mean something else in other contexts. So that's just a sort of Tibetan vision of the Buddha beginning, and there are a lot of great stories in that account. But let me tell it like in my own words, the Buddha's life. It's illustrating something about what we're doing today and what Tibet is about, which this connects to. And that is, Buddha was born, and of course there's an extreme way of seeing Buddha as just an emanation, what they call a nirmanakaya, a magical emanation of someone who already was a Buddha, but who emanated as a human being in the sort of top of the most developed society in Eurasia on the planet at that time, which was in India, and then showed the path to people to give example of what you have to do to try to transform yourself and to reach the evolutionary stage of enlightenment, of a Buddha where you simultaneously feel you're infinite and all beings. At the same time, you can manifest like separated entities to interact with beings, not just one, actually. You can manifest many bodies. So there's one view where this Buddha was, where Shakyamuni Buddha, who was born as Siddhartha, chose a certain family, chose the mother and father, you know, landed in a certain place at a certain time in history, performed these various deeds, actually chose to be reborn without knowing exactly who he was, with just an intuition, so that he genuinely did have to unfold his ignorance, to, you know, was re-embodied like with ignorance, actually. And there are emanations, you know, they have this thing of a Tibetan thing where they have what they call tulkus, you know, these so-called Rinpoches. Well, being a Rinpoche means you're a nirmanakaya, so an emanation of a Buddha, supposedly. But you might be one where a Buddha emanated as an ignorant person. So that might explain why sometimes tulkus misbehave, which they do sometimes. Maybe they haven't recovered their full Buddha knowledge. But they're supposed to. That's what they're supposed to do. And they voluntarily decide to be reborn without their knowledge, but with an intuition enabling them perhaps to regain it, something like that. And then there are those Buddhists who see the Buddha as really just an ordinary person who was ignorant and so forth, and he was a prince, and he was a spoiled brat, kind of, but he was very smart, and then he eventually, like, broke away, and he became a Buddha. He became enlightened, which is not really much different from any of his students who became enlightened themselves by studying what he taught, and they don't really necessarily explain why he was able to make such a great effect as a teacher, while the others were not necessarily able to do that. So they don't really get into that issue of the difference. And when you talk to those people and debate them about how come Buddha was so remarkable, what was that? They just say he was luckier. He had some good luck. So there's a whole gamut of views about a Buddha's life. But the Mahayana tends toward being aware of the sort of you could sort of say divine, but it isn't really divine, because he's never presented as a creator of any kind. Buddha doesn't create the world. In fact, Buddha finds solace in the uncreated reality of the world, and he helps people deconstruct a world of suffering, actually. So he uncreates a world of suffering and brings people back to the actual world, which is a world of bliss. He eventually reveals it to be, and actually right away, when he's enlightened, he reveals it to be. So anyway, whether it's sort of a divine show, you know, the Mahayana version of Buddha's biography is called Lalita Vistara, which means something like the greatest show on earth, like P.T. Barnum. It actually means that. Lalita means a play. It can mean a play like playful. It can mean a play like a drama. And Vistara means magnificent or expansive. So a magnificent play or a magnificent show. I like to say greatest show on earth. Mm-hmm. And actually it's been my life motivation. Or wish, which perhaps another life I'll get to do, is to make a film of it, you know. Super Buddha, you know. Something like that, you know. And I've been discouraged that, you know, nobody likes Superman, so you can't make a film where somebody's already very enlightened or something. Never mind. That's my personal complaint. It is a marvelous show, though. Anyway, he gets reborn, and he doesn't. His mother is not a virgin. She's actually a favorite queen of a king named Suddhodana in a wealthy, wonderful, right on the foothills of Himalaya kingdom at the top of India, kind of the Shakya's kingdom, it's called. And when he's born, the mother, and he's conceived, though, without the father's involvement. That is, when the mother's on a retreat away from the father. So there's no seed from the father. And this is a typical trope in mythic terms, where someone who's going to be a huge rebel against the patriarchal culture is born without the father. You know, and of course Jesus has the same trope, and I think Hercules, and when they have divine fathers, you know, here, you know, mythic heroes have that trope. And Buddha has it, but a little different, because they're not so uptight, maybe, as the Western people, Mediterranean people, so she doesn't have to be a virgin. You know. But he's conceived without the father. So he's sort of magically conceived, and she's in ecstasy throughout the whole pregnancy. And there is an actual text where she describes what it's like. And it's a very busy pregnancy. She feels like her womb is like the universe. And then there are all these deities and beings and magical creatures coming in and out. And Buddha's sitting in a little pagoda inside her womb, and he's teaching them as an infant. As an embryo, he's already teaching. And she describes in a marvelous way. It's actually amazing. It's like, imagine if, I bet there was, frankly, I bet in Christian literature there was some record of Mary saying something about what it was like. I mean, you conceive God's child, and it must be groovy. I mean, it must have, like, good hormones going on with that. But you never hear from her, right? Except she's out there worrying when this is the horrible things happen to him. But there must be, but it got suppressed by the Mediterranean patriarchs, probably. You know, women are a little less honored, perhaps, in that part of the time, the part of the world in those days. So she's in this blissful condition. And then again, when she's ready to deliver, she leaves, which is part of that culture, she leaves the husband's house to go to the father's house. To her own birth house, and gives birth there. It's the usual pattern in that of the aristocratic royal families in that time. But she doesn't get there, and she gives birth in nature, in a garden, sort of like a manger, parallel to a manger. There's one Japanese scholar who has found 22 parallel incidents in the baby Jesus story and the Buddha story, the Buddha life and the Jesus life. And it's a very interesting study. Kajime Nakamura. And some of you might be interested in that, and I can give you that reference. And then she's feeling a little tired in this garden where she stops on the way to her father's palace in another kingdom. And she leans on a tree, and then Buddha very kindly, you know, natural childbirth of the best kind, just emerges from her side without any incision or without any labor or without any problem. He just floats through the molecules of her side. And he stands on the ground on his 2 feet, and he holds up this one finger like this, and he says, "I'm the best thing on 2 feet." And he walks here and there a little bit. But then when the father is summoned and comes, he goes and he starts acting like a baby again, because he doesn't want to make the father nervous that he might be some weird creature or something, talking at birth. But the mother and the bride, you know, the attendants don't mind. And it's a scene like where there's animals and lions and tigers and deers all lying around, and everything is blooming all over, although it's early spring. So there's a very elaborated, you know, magical kind of moment. And then an unusual thing happens, which the mother never comes back to her body. And then this is rationalized in various ways in different traditions. The Pali people say that this always happens with a Buddha's mother who's in their last life, the Buddha life, because if a mother were to be with her son as a Buddha son, Bodhisattva son, in his last life and growing up, and then he would leave home, which the Buddha does eventually, in around 29 usually, or mid-20s, then that would break her heart. You know, that he'd go and become an ascetic and struggle and suffer, you know, the way he did. So that they always just pass away upon giving birth. And then that's the most down to thing. And then the most elaborate thing is where she says to her husband, sort of, she says, okay, I did my job. I brought Buddha to birth as a prince. And from now on, I don't feel like the infrastructure around here. I'm not into the plumbing in your palace. I'm not into this body. That's it for me. I'm going to the Indra's heaven, to Olympus, basically. Indra's heaven at 33 is the Indian Olympus. And she does go there. And she's just too blissed out to sort of pull herself together and go around and be the queen, you know, and be the mom. And she has a sister who's also a queen, who it becomes the mother, foster mother of the Buddha, a Prajapati, and basically is his mother in life. But, I mean, some people, like Mark, I'm always joking around with Mark Epstein, because he thinks this is a big trauma for Buddha, losing his birth mother. And he must have known. And therefore, he was trying to fill. And it's just really, Freud also thought that Buddha was seeking to return to the womb. He was so freaked out. And that in Nirvana, it's just a return to the womb. You know, it's the oceanic feeling of going back into the womb. But meanwhile, in Buddhism, they don't think it's that much fun to be in the womb. That's why they kick as soon as they can. And when mom rides in a bumpy Maserati or something, they really kick. They don't want to be bumped when she has a cold ice cream or a hot spice. But you know, the being doesn't like it in the womb. In other words, they have sufferings in the womb in Buddhist medicine and so on. But who knows? So anyway, then he's born and then he's brought up. Then he's a complete... Then there's a monk who comes, the soothsayer. Father kind of freaks out, but he had many wives, and he was deeply in love with Maya, but he respects her wishes, so to speak, and he has other, and Prajapati is her sister, but also beautiful, wonderful queen, and he has lots of other, he has a harem the way they did, and so he manages, and then he's very proud of his son, and he takes the son to, this is another parallel episode, according to Hajime Nakamura. He takes the son to the ancestral Vedic temple, Brahminical temple, and when he takes him into the temple, the deities on their pedestals, you know, Brahma, Shiva, etc., or the earlier Vedic forms of those, Rudra, etc., they come to life. They get down off the pedestals, they come over and they bow to the baby, then they go back and get on the pedestals and turn back into stone. Or metal, or whatever they were. There's an incident like that. And then Nakamura points to there's an incident apparently in some apocryphal gospel. And this is a Middle Eastern versus India difference, actually, so it's kind of amusing. And where Joseph and Mary go into an Egyptian temple. And when they take baby Jesus into an Egyptian temple, all the Egyptian god statues explode into dust. And they don't get up again. They get wasted. You know, anti-idolatry sort of story, which apparently didn't get into the four main gospels, but was in one of the, Nakamura found that. So there's all that kind of parallel things in the two stories. So then, and then the father calls that soothsayer. Actually, the soothsayer comes by himself with a bunch of followers, flying through the air, levitating through the air, like he must have taken Maharishi's course or something. And he lands there, and he says, I want to see this baby. You know? And the father says, okay, tell me about my son. And then when he looks at him, he's smiling and very, very happy with this radiant child. And then he starts weeping. So then the father gets all uptight and says, why are you weeping? And was something wrong with the kid, or what's that matter? You know? He says, no. This kid is far out. He's going to be a perfect Buddha. But I'm crying because I will be dead by the time he does become a perfect Buddha. I will not get a chance to receive his teaching in this life. So that's why I'm weeping for myself. And then the father says, but what do you mean he's going to be a Buddha? What does that mean? The father's a king, right? Warrior class, that is, you know. He's a general in an army. And he says, oh, well, okay, if you don't want him to be a Buddha by leaving home and becoming a Buddha, becoming a Shramana, you know, seeker, and then a Buddha, then you have to make sure he doesn't know anything about suffering in his youth. Until he's 30 years old, you have to keep him in the household. And then maybe he'll be a king. And if he's a king, wow, he'll conquer the whole world. So dad is like, oh, that's great. I want to conquer the world, my son. So then he's brought up as a spoiled brat with all kind of dancing girls and a wild adolescence and what have you. He also learns everything. He goes to some teacher and he knows 45 languages more than the teacher does right away. And mathematics, he's like, he's a genius. It's a prodigy. And so he doesn't take his studies very seriously. And he learns the martial arts because he's supposed to be a general and a king, but he doesn't pay much attention and he's much better than anybody else. And he has some thoughtful moments. Mark Epstein loves the moment where he's sitting under a tree as a child, maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, and the father is doing the ritual plowing that the king is supposed to do at the beginning of springtime to start the planting, the farmers. A sort of ritual thing where the king plows the first furrow, and then he notices that the plow is killing a lot of insects. And so he kind of withdraws and he goes into a kind of samadhi state, the Buddha does. And then they say, where's Siddhartha? What's his name? Siddhartha means one who will achieve his aim. And where's Siddhartha? And they say, well, he was over under the tree. And then they notice that there's a light around him and he's like in total samadhi naturally. So then the father gets uptight and goes, wake him up and get him over here. So that's a very important incident, Mark Epstein thinks, where he has a gentle, peaceful, blissful, dhyana or meditative state. And he has another wonderful incident in that youth is where his half-brother, who's the actual son of Prajapati, the foster mother, and therefore always jealous of the Buddha, of Siddhartha, shoots a goose, a wild goose, flying, or a swan, I think a goose, Hamsa. And then the swan falls down near where Buddha is, and then Buddha grabs it, and then pulls out the arrow and binds the wound and saves his life. And then Devadatta comes and says, I shot it, I'm the hunter, it's mine. Buddha says, no, I'm saving his life, it's mine. And then they take it to the court, and the judge is fined for the Buddha. So then Devadatta gnashes his teeth again, and all this happens. So then, at a certain age, he becomes sick of all his partying, and he's starting to get pensive. And then the father, his wise men advise the father, well, maybe he's tired of all this sexuality, this meaningless sexuality, and he wants to be married. He should have a wife, So then there's a wonderful scene where all the most beautiful maidens in the country come. And he gives jewels to all of them. And then when he's out of jewels, this last one comes who came last and late because her father didn't want her trying out for this, so to speak, even though he was the top prince. Because the father thought he was a wimp because he was always hanging around the pleasure palace. He wasn't a good warrior, and the father was a warrior, and the kings are warriors. She doesn't want his daughter marrying a wimp, but she has a destiny to go, she feels. So she comes, and he has no more jewels when she gets there. And then in love at first sight, boing, So he takes off his own diadem and emerald thing, gives it to her. Wonderful scene. But then the father gets up and says, no way, just because he gives him a jewel. He can't have my daughter. He has to have a tournament and win the tournament to get her. Whoever is the winner of the tournament gets my daughter, not him. He says, thinking that Buddha will lose because he's been hanging around the harem, right? So then Buddha has to beat up Devadatta again and everybody else, He does all kinds of things. It's a wonderful tournament scene. And then they are married and then they live together. But then they live together a long time with no child. And they have a really good sex life. That's important to note. For those shrinks who think Buddha was just seeking something because he didn't have a good sex life, they have a great one. In one of the poems, they're on their honeymoon and they roll off a low roof of their pleasure pavilion and they land in a lotus bed and they don't notice that they fell off. So they must have really been going wild. And then their attendants come and hold up saris around them, this and that, and apparently they carry on. So there are scenes like that. Indian literature is so sweet, it really is. But then, at a certain moment, she does get pregnant, and she has a child, a son. And at that moment, the father is overjoyed. He thinks he's gotten there. But that time, Buddha's 29. And he thinks, now I've got him nailed. Because the tradition is, when the crown prince has a son, the son becomes crown prince. The father can retire, because lifespan not necessarily that long, in his 40s or late 40s, maybe 50s. And father goes to a kind of retreat place, pavilion, goes to Florida and takes a break. And the son gets the headache of running the kingdom. And so he says, okay, you have a son. Hey, you're the king. We're going to set up the coronation. Buddha says, okay, Dad, as a king, I'm supposed to protect my subjects, right? Oh, and by the way, during this time, before this, he's gone out of his pleasure circle, his Potemkin village, so to speak, pleasure village, four times. And the first time he saw an old person, second time a sick person, third time a dead body, and fourth time an ascetic. You know, a seeker, a person wearing orange robes and, you know, going around sort of in a more samadhic, sort of peaceful vibe, seeking the meaning of life and death, this kind of person, you know, yogi kind of, shramana. They had no Buddhists at that time, but they had people who were seeking forest ascetics. You know. So he had seen these four things. So as they say, he went out with his charioteer, and the father said, well, if he's going to go out, I want a Potemkin perfect village and town and everything. I don't want him to see anything unpleasant. But he does see these four things, they say, which I think is a little unrealistic. And I think that his wife had sneaked him out of the palace to be more down-to-earth and realistic and had showed him the reality of that. In my version of Buddha movie, she takes him out to a soup kitchen, to a hospital, to a, you know, to a mortuary ceremony, you know, and he sees these things. She gets him hip of what's going on in the world, you know. That's what I feel. She doesn't get credit, I feel. Yashoda, she's a great woman. And then Buddha says, no. He says, he says, yes, I'm supposed to protect. Yes, son, you're going to protect your subjects. And Buddha says, well, that means I can protect them from sickness, old age, death, and suffering. No, son, you're not going to do that. That's for the priests. The gods take care of that. You just defend against the enemies, and you run the kingdom, collect the taxes, this kind of thing. And Buddha says, yeah, but that's not my real problems of my people. The real problems are sickness, old age, and death. So I'm not going to be king because I couldn't do a good job. I'm going to go find out a way to protect them from what's really bothering them. And really? No, you don't want to be king? So then the father locks him up and sends in a bunch of Brahmin psychiatrists, you know, priests, you know, to like get him to shape up and get back onto the worldly treadmill, you know. So then he escapes. And then that's one of the big deeds of his life, one of the four great deeds of his life, where he escapes. Cuts off his hair, takes off his clothes. He trades clothes with some ascetic who has these kind of cemetery shrouds. And the horse weeps, the charioteer weeps, the wife weeps when she gets back. But she weeps, interestingly, not just because he left her and the child, but because he didn't take her with him. She wants to attain enlightenment. She'd like to go. That's really what the reason she gives. She got a little bit dwells on the thing about the little boy's not going to have daddy when he grows up. But mainly, she's upset that he didn't take her along. And he didn't take her along with him by himself. So then 6 years he spends torturing him. Well, he meets two teachers. First one teaches him to reach the formless realm state, or the realm state of absolute nothingness, which is like your secularist's nirvana, state of total unconsciousness, but one in which you come into it like that's the ultimate place, you know, you think. It's past the realm of infinite space and infinite consciousness, sort of absolute nothingness, the ultimate quiet, right? And he enters such a state. And then in one day, they say, you know, he realizes that. And then his teacher says, wow, you know, you really have aptitude. I am getting old and I will die soon. You will now lead my ashram here. And Buddha says, no, thank you, because that state is not the final state. That's just an escape state away from the relative, this part of the relative world. But it's a relative state in itself, even though it seems like an infinite state. An infinite state that has a boundary between it and the relative differentiated world is not infinite, because it had a boundary in space and time. So it's a relative mental state, but it's not the ultimate. Sorry. So the guy's very disappointed. He leaves, he goes to another ashram. And in that one, the guy goes still further. And he reaches a state which is one step beyond the nothingness state, which he also realizes in one day. He teaches the state beyond consciousness and unconsciousness. Sort of a non-dual state of being totally infinite and unconscious and yet conscious of that in some way. And you are the whole universe. Your consciousness is. And not you as an ordinary subject, because there's no object. So it's a seemingly very far out state, actually. It is actually a very far out state. And again, he rejects that. And then again, he's offered the ownership of that ashram, the leadership of that ashram, and he again abandons it. And he says, that's not it either, sorry. And then he leaves and he goes off and he starts torturing himself, which he does for 6 years, starving. I don't know if any of you have ever seen, there's a marvelous sculpture in the Lahore Museum of him. It's from Gandhara, you know, from when Afghanistan was a Buddhist kingdom down into North India, the Kushan kingdom. They made those dark stone carved statues, and the statue of the skeletal Buddha with the ribs and the veins. It's an amazing looking statue. I met that statue in 1962 when I was doing my fakir trip to India, yogi trip to India, and I saw that. It really blew me away. I was identifying with that. And it's really beyond, you know. One grain of rice a day, or sesame, I think one grain of rice a week, one sesame seed a day, and water, a little bit of water, and sitting naked in the sun and in the winter and summer, etc. I mean, amazing. And even there's a story that his mother appeared to him from heaven saying, cut it out, you're going to kill yourself like that. And he said, don't worry, Mom, I'll be up, I'll come teach you. He promised he would come teach her. When he became enlightened, he sort of intuited he would get out of that. To them, he comes to a point where, and there's several versions of that story. The one I like is the tantric one, which the ordinary one is that he, at some point, he decides that this is silly, he's not getting anywhere, and he's just ruining his body, and he is going to collapse if he keeps that up. And some village girl brings a bowl of yogurt and rice to him and honey, which he eats. And then he decides that the torturing the body is the wrong extreme. It's too extreme and it's silly. And his mind can't function and he has to figure things out. He's close to figuring it out. He's been meditating. But his body is so weak, he's being distracted by that. So he eats food, takes a bath, cuts his nails and hair, and cleans his rags that he was living in and makes like a robe for himself out of pieces of a cemetery shroud colored orange by saffron, which apparently was the tradition at that time. And then his five compartners in asceticism get disgusted with him and they leave. And then he goes and he gets fed and he gets grass. He sits under the tree. He says, I'm not moving from this spot until I have figured it out. I'm going to figure it out, he says. Then he sits there a day and a night. And his body fills out like perfect from the one bowl of this, you know, which they don't explain that. They just say it's the gods come and fill it with all these vitamins or whatever. Super, super energy food. But the tantric thing is really, I like it better, the tantric version. The tantric version is, he's still pushing ahead with his stubborn thing about he's going to leave everything. He's going to give himself up in a certain way, conscious way, and to achieve awareness of the infinite of everything. And so he decides, well, I'm going without water, going without food, going without clothing, etc., etc., going without sleep. The one thing I haven't gone without is breathing. So I'm not going to draw another breath until I get it. So he's like not going to breathe again. He's like stopping his breath, like a yogi. And he's passing out kind of from stopping his breath. And then he hears like someone snapping their fingers. And he looks up and he sees this beautiful goddess standing in front of him saying, what are you doing? You're going to choke yourself like that. And she says, come with me if you really want to get somewhere. And then his subtle body leaves his coarse body. It leaves it kind of staying in a state of cataleptic trance. And his subtle body, you know, because he's a real yogi, you know, she takes her with her to high heaven there. And there he's initiated in the mandala of Vairochana. You know, like a certain mandala, you know. And he's installed in that different feeling about sort of what they call the divine pride and the divine perception, the divine conception of himself as a Buddha and the universe as a Buddha-verse. And he's sort of given the blessing to see it that way. And that's why his body fills out and he turns cold and this and that, because it's the subtle body. When the subtle body then comes back and reoccupies the coarse body, then the body suddenly is glowing and has its full health back. And that, to me, is much more valuable. I prefer that. But, you know, never mind. The usual thing is he just takes a bowl of yogurt and rice and honey. So then he has three insights during that night. He has a little struggle with Mara. The devil comes up to him and offers him dominion over the earth, all knowledge, any power and riches, whatever he wants. And he says, that's really boring. I'm not interested. The devil then sends a bunch of girls, his daughters, And he looks at them and he says, girls, stop dancing like that. You're going to give yourself a hernia. And he sees through them. He sees their skeletons and he's completely uninterested. And then they're rejected. And then the devil attacks them. They throw mountains at him and bombs and whatever they can with the whole demon army. And it all just falls at his feet like flowers. So the devil can't disturb him with either lust or hatred. So then the devil comes up to him and says, what is this? What are you, arrogant? What is your power? Who asked you to be Buddha? What is that? I'm going to be Buddha. I'm going to save all beings from suffering. Devil says. And then the Buddha says to him, says, well, how did you get to be the king of the devils, of the Maras? I can tell you, in my previous life, many aeons ago, you had a moment of compassion for another devil. And that gave you the merit to be king of the devils, although mostly you do nasty things. You're the big tempter, you know. And, oh, well, you're right. I can remember that. I'm a kind of demonic god, the devil says. And you're my witness. And what's your excuse to be Buddha? And he said, well, I did things like, I did everything. I gave my body, my life, my kingdom, my wife, my children, my eyes, my ears, my head, blood, everything to beings millions of times over many aeons. I accumulated so much merit. Every single being, I've done something fantastic. And now I'm going to be Buddha and help them become enlightened. And he said, well, you say so many things. The devil says, but who's your witness? Who could possibly witness all this stuff you claim? So then Buddha puts this one hand, sitting cross-legged, puts the one hand down that you often see in Buddha statues with the one hand down here. And he's touching the earth. And he's saying, I call Mother Earth to witness. And then Mother Earth comes out and she starts reciting Buddha's former lives, the Jataka tales. And there are more and less elaborate versions in the different stories. It's the one Mother Goddess, a Mother Earth goddess, Prithivi is her name in Sanskrit, like Persephone in Greek, her same being, and starts reciting them. And in the more elaborate ones, she comes up with 16 Earth goddesses who start to do a multimedia show of all of the Buddha's different previous lives. You know, when Buddha was the lassie, when Buddha was old Yeller, when Buddha was Bugs Bunny, when Buddha was Mickey Mouse, and he all did all these great things, you know, for everybody. King of the monkeys, and then... Then the devil goes, drat! And he goes back to his thing and says, I'll get you later. He doesn't destroy the devil, but he just overwhelms him like that. So then he's quiet and he meditates. And the first thing he understands is he remembers at the event horizon of realizing the nature of reality being nirvana, he realizes all his previous lives. And my theory is that the reason he can remember infinite previous lives at that point is not only that he's coming to a different relationship with time, but also he has overcome. He's reached the point where, by being in the event horizon of realizing the reality of nirvana, he realizes that he always was made of bliss, that everything has always been bliss in every body he was in. He was always bliss, even when he died, or he was tortured, or he gave his life away, or when some other horrible thing happened, or when he was in a hell, or in a bad state. It was just bliss anyway. He was just configuring it wrongly by his particular ignorance at that time. So that's why we don't remember our own previous lives, because we suffered. We died, we didn't want to die. We suffered in the lives. We're frightened of doing that. So we have like that wonderful human thing where you don't remember what it was like when you broke your leg or your arm. You don't really remember the pain. So that's why we don't remember those previous lives so easily. But he remembered them, zoom, like that, all like infinitely. And then second, and more to the point of compassion, actually, he remembered everybody else's previous lives. So he realized, of course, that he'd been in every conceivable relationship with every other person. Totally. Forever. Everyone had been mom. Everyone had been beloved. Everyone had been enemy also. But why dwell on that? Mainly, they'd been mothers to him. And he was linked to them in that way. He'd been mothers to them, too. Because you have infinity, you can't say anything is excluded in eternity. If you're having repeated relationships, you've all been everything to each other. So those two things he remembered, and that second memory is the compassion entanglement with all living beings that he experienced. Because he and they had been interwoven with each other in infinite past lives. And then when he saw about them, he also saw all their different future prospects. And he saw all their multiple possible futures. And he remembered his will to compassion toward them. And he wanted them to have a minimal evolutionary trajectory to their own freedom and their own realization of the nirvanic nature of reality. So that was his sort of compassionate commitment to stay with them in, and to optimize their future evolutionary development. And he sort of spread himself that way into the future as well as into the past. And then he achieved nirvana, finally, everything, the perfection of everything, and he had a big grin on his face. And then he said, well, sabshi utel usel turtel dumache tuti tower chuchi korne sula tenjang kor mindube mima nakti said the chiperne, he said in Tibetan anyway, which is profound, peaceful, clear light or transparent, complication free or trouble free, and uncreated, like an elixir of immortality, is the reality I have discovered. Whoever I would teach it to, they wouldn't understand. Without speaking, better I stay alone in the forest without speaking, he says, the second part, which of course he didn't really necessarily intend, but it just was his feeling, you know. Like nobody, it's impossible to get, people won't get it. But actually, it was a message to the gods. In my opinion, he was being coy. He was waiting for his agent and his manager. And what better manager than Brahma, the creator, who people thought was the creator? Then Brahma starts bugging him. He then stays 49 days in the woods, enjoying the incredible vision of infinite bliss, bliss void indivisible, as they call it, bliss freedom indivisible. And then Brahma keeps coming and bugging and saying, go teach people, go teach people. Giving him visions. He gives him a vision of a lotus pond, and there are different types of flowers in the lotus pond, and then the rain falls. And then Brahma says, look, the different lotuses are different. They don't all accept the water the same way, but they all are nourished by the rainfall. So just go and rain out the teaching and stop acting like nobody's going to understand it. And doing all these things, and I'll help you. And here's the wheel of Dharma that all the Buddhas have used, the sort of like the equivalent of a royal wheel symbol that you see on top of Buddhist temples. You know, there's this wheel with two deers looking at it. That wheel symbolizes the wheel of the teaching. And so he gets a lot of, you know, Brahma has to ask him and ask him and ask. The other gods also ask him a lot, often. And then, by the way, before he goes to give his first teaching of Four Noble Truths, these merchants come by, signifying the long-term relationship of Buddhism and capitalism. Seriously. Why? Because Buddha was a traitor to his class. He was a warrior. But the warrior way of aggrandizing or getting prosperity is not very good. You go to the neighboring kingdom and you kill them, destroy them, and you take their wealth. But then you've killed your customer. And there's no one to deal with and exchange anything with next year. They can't make something for you. So it's really a zero-sum game. Whereas, merchant class, they go and they make deals and they bargain and they niggle and haggle with each other, but each one contributes something and each one is enriched, ideally to some extent, gets something out of it, and then they get to their creativity and they produce new things and they come and trade again the next year. So it expands wealth much better than militarism, capitalism does. So the merchant classes always were the ones to support the Buddha and everything. Anyway, these two merchants called Chapuchan and Balika come, and their caravan, a trade caravan, gets stuck in the mud near where Buddha's relaxing in the woods. And then they see a light over there in the woods, and they go over and they see this ascetic there. And they say, oh, well, let's give him some lunch while we're waiting for him to be dug out of the mud. And then Buddha says, yeah, well, that's a great idea, guys. You know, if you give lunch to sincere seekers who are seeking reality, you know, thinking of his future community, no doubt, he said, then you will prosper in your journey, you know. So please go ahead, and here's a begging bowl. Then the gods brought him a begging bowl. You know, they have like usual methods like that. And they give him a big lunch. And then they go back, and their thing is dug out, and they go off and make a fortune in town, you know, in Benares, where they're going. This is a nice story. He doesn't mention a word about suffering to them. He doesn't say, oh, it's suffering, and it doesn't say that. Then he decides, well, okay, I'll go teach. Who do I teach? And he realizes his two yoga teachers have died, so he can't teach them and their people at the ashram, although he will eventually. And he five ascetics, he goes to the five guys who gave him up and went somewhere. So he goes and teaches them. Then he teaches them the Four Noble Truths.